Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Hey, very quiet beginning.
Happy New Year,
Happy
lads.
New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Mics are hotter, so I didn't want to do my normal yell and clip and then adjust. So we're going to do NPR voices today.
Norm, new dad.
Yes.
I have been listening to a song that has been really affecting me this last few days.
Okay.
This song is by Brandi Carlile, not Belinda Carlile.
Heaven is a place on earth.
No.
Okay.
This is Brandi Carlile as a singer, and this song is called The Mother. And I first came into contact with this song over the summer. I was doing a panel about environmentalism at what was the big festival that was happening
in San Francisco?
Outside Lands.
Okay.
At Outside Lands, they had a comedy tent. And in that comedy tent, they also had some serious political panels. And I sat on one about climate change. And one of the wonderful radicals in the panel with me sang this song as her final send-off for the panel. And it was really affecting. And it's about a mom. The lyrics are things like, welcome to the end of the end, alone inside your mind. You're tethered to another and you're worried all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And then there's this part in the lyric that gets me every single time. She says, the outside of my windows are the mountains and the snow. Oh, I hold you while you're sleeping and I wish that I could go. All my rowdy friends are out accomplishing their dreams, but I am the mother of Evangeline.
Ooh,
and then she says, chills. They still have their morning papers and their coffee and their time. And they still enjoy the evenings with the skeptics and the wine. Oh, but all the wonders I have seen, I will see a second time. I will see a second time from inside of the ages of your eyes.
Ooh.
Oh, man.
And it's like it's choking me up right now just a little bit. And it is like such a... it's a protest song about motherhood and about dedication, and it's a beautiful song and about fighting the power and speaking truth to power. And with my kids being 20 and now regularly dining with them and talking to them about their lives and their futures, the older that your kids get, the more you remember what it was like to be that age.
I mean, that is the one thing that is striking me. My daughter's 6 now, turned 6 this month, and we've reached the period in her life that I can remember what it was like to be 5.
Yes.
Right? I remember going to kindergarten. I remember being scared walking in that door the first time. I remember being excited about playing with the toy kitchen at kindergarten, right?
And you remember your parents' reactions to those things, mm-hmm. too.
Not really.
No.
Yeah, no, that's the funny thing. Like, I remember, I sent my mom a note the morning after Christmas, and I was like, Mom, I never really appreciated how hard you and Dad worked to make... Christmas a thing, because Gina and I looked up at the end of the night on the 25th and we're just like, man, I feel like I've been kicked in the head 4 or 5 times today, because we were up all night the night before putting stuff together and then making food and having people over and the whole it's a lot.
Yeah.
And you don't realize that until you're doing it for somebody else. And it has to be surreal to have humans that are spawned of you that you can have grown-up conversations with, especially for Norm. I mean, you can't even imagine that.
No, I can't imagine it, but it's already surreal now to look at the face of my child. And all babies kind of have the baby features, kind of look alike, but even at 2 months now, to see some of the features develop that are a reflection of yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And
that is
and your dad.
Yep,
he makes a face that looks just like your dad.
Yeah, and to see that, and it is very much we spent New Year's Eve over at Will's place, and Will's holding my baby, and there's a photo I have of the baby over Will's shoulder, and I shit you not, it was a Benjamin Button moment where it was like, this is Will as old Kate Blanchett holding the child of me. At the end of the movie.
So awesome.
Which is the weirdest
that's
thing.
I'm glad you didn't share that in the moment, Norm.
He's
a sweet baby, by the way.
We ended up not... We were just on a long drive. If you follow me on Twitter, you saw a lot of pictures from it. My wife and the dogs and Thing 2 and I spent about 2.5 weeks driving from here to San Jose. Sorry, Santa Fe.
I was going to say, that's a pretty...
we took Mission Street and we ate...
Hey, stopping every
El Camino, all
El
the way
Camino
down.
El Camino Real. We went to Santa Fe, from here to L.A. to St. George to Winslow. I took a picture on a corner in Winslow, yeah, Arizona. Yep.
So you had both trained to San Jose and driven there.
Santa Fe.
Or sorry, Santa
yes.
Fe.
Yes.
If you take the train to San Jose.
Which one do you recommend more?
Oh, I love taking the train, but it was great driving with the dogs. Mm. And sorry, for New Year's Eve, we ended up coming back here a little early. Huxley's ACL was acting up, and we wanted to get him. He got a little vigorous in Joshua Tree.
Oh, well, you know, who doesn't?
He was hanging out there with Eric Roberts.
Yeah. And my wife and I were lying in bed, and I was like, you know, I was thinking, it's bedtime. I'm going to take off my glasses and go to sleep. And I took off my glasses, and she was like, what time is it? I'm like, oh, my God, it's 11:58. Let's go get a timer and figure out when midnight is. And she's like, or we could just listen.
Yeah.
And she was totally right. And so we're just lying there in bed, and we heard the sounds of New Year's hitting the Mission District, which was really
tons
lovely.
Tons of fireworks.
Yeah.
But it was slow. It was like,
surround sound.
And then you start to hear the fireworks and the gunshots. And then I was asleep by 12:05. It was a super, super chill New Year's.
So this was the year my daughter asked to stay up. This is the first year she's been aware that it's a thing. And she was like, can I stay up late and ring in the New Year? I'm like, yeah, sure. And about 10:55, she was starting to fade. And my wife looked over and she said, hey, you know, it's almost midnight, isn't it? And I said, no, it's like 5 till 11, because I'm a dope.
Oh, ooh.
But she was asleep. She was totally zonked, so she completely missed. I was like, oh, no, it's 5 minutes. So we went outside in the backyard and started blowing the horns and stuff at 11 o'clock. Thankfully, two people in my neighborhood must have had a similar situation, because they rang in the Denver New Year at 11 p.m. with a couple of fireworks. She's like, you know, I kind of expected there to be more fireworks. And then she went right to sleep. Didn't move.
Nice.
So it was very good.
Well done.
Yeah. That's good.
Years later, she'll listen to this and realize that you lied.
The lies. I mean, so if I have some advice for Norm coming out of, like, there's a bunch of lies that we tell hey, if you're a parent and you have kids in the car, maybe pause the podcast now. We'll come back. Listen to the rest of this one by yourself. The lies that we tell our kids complicate both parents' lives and the kids' lives a lot, right? Like there's the classic ones, you know, that we don't need to get into, mm-hmm, just in case people didn't heed my warning. But then there's also stuff like the Elf on the Shelf. I don't know if you guys know. You probably didn't have the Elf on the Shelf.
No, way after my time.
So the Elf on the Shelf, you had this elf, and you can buy it at Target, which makes the whole thing a little shady to begin with, in my opinion. but people move it around, and if it doesn't move, it's because the kid's been bad or something. We don't do it, but like it's a thing that people do.
Oh.
It's another one of the lies we tell our kids.
This is a book, by the way. You realize the lies we tell our children.
Probably, yeah.
Or a podcast. Yeah.
The Switch Witch is the new one. So you do this when you get, like, when your kid comes home with 5 pounds of candy on Halloween, you'd like, man, I don't want my kid to eat 5 pounds of candy. So you let him eat like a pound of candy, and then trade the other 4 pounds for a toy of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
If I were doing that over again, instead of making up some character that's going to come do this good thing for the child, I would just say, look, we'll exchange 4 pounds of candy for you in a very transactional nature. It's much easier.
Totally.
But now there's just another. Anyway, don't lie to your kid any more than you have to. That's my that's my advice to you.
I hate that thing that happens the day after Halloween where people post all these videos of telling their kids they've eaten all their candy and they watch them get really upset.
That's awful. Jimmy Kimmel thing, right?
Yeah.
What is entertaining about that? There's nothing, as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing entertaining about trolling your children.
They're doing the same thing now with turning off their TV with Fortnite.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Yeah. I trolled my kids once and it was a good prank. Which was, we were watching, I think, season 4 or 5 of American Idol.
Oh, we remember this.
Yeah.
Yeah, you told the story.
I took them to LA and bought them tickets. Yes. I managed to get them tickets to the finale and I didn't tell them about it until we were in front of them.
That's not a troll.
That's a surprise.
That's a total.
Being really nice.
A good surprise.
Yeah. What's a lie that you remember your parents telling you that you remember the moment?
My parents didn't, like, aside from the big things that everybody lies about, my parents didn't really. They were pretty. I mean, I'm sure that we had a dog that got hit by a car or something.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either. We didn't even believe in many of the. Well, yeah, I guess there was a soft agreement to believe in the Christmas lies.
Mm. Yeah,
my parents, because I have two brothers, and so there were three of us. They would make two things into three, and we were just didn't make sense.
What do you mean, like KFC does with chicken breasts?
Kinda. Yeah. Like, for example, like a fish cheek. Like okay. The softest part of a fish is in its cheek. And so my mom would pick out the fish cheek and give one to my brother, pick out the other fish cheek and give one to me. And then my other brother, oh, I found another fish cheek.
But it wasn't a fish cheek.
No.
What if none of you were getting fish cheeks and they were just eating the fish cheeks?
And then it wasn't until 4 or 5 years old. Like, there are only two cheeks.
Maybe you got the butt on cheeks. The
fish butt cheeks.
Fish butt cheeks.
This is a great band.
This is the kids' version of the fake calamari.
Wait, what?
You know, the pig anus.
What?
You know.
No, this is
there
not.
There was a whole Washington Post or New York Times story where they tested the people were selling counterfeit calamari, but it's really
like intestine?
Just pig intestines.
Wow. I had no idea.
And there's a big, they did
my
big
Google
taste
alert
test
for pig anus must not have popped up that day.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a whole thing. There's a counterfeit calamari, and it's just the sphincter.
Awful.
Side
this
note,
is a really ranging podcast today.
Inside baseball. This is the last time we're using these headphones.
Oh, okay.
The problem with the left ear is this, and it's
That'll make you crazy.
Oh yeah.
Do you want to trade? You can have mine if
no,
you want.
No, okay. It's fine. Hey, so we didn't get a chance to see many movies. I still haven't seen Spider-Verse, which I'm dying to see.
This is the best movie I saw last year that wasn't Paddington 2.
Super excited about that.
I did see that.
My son, thing too, is an avid boulderer and rock climber. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons we stopped in Joshua Tree, which, by the way, I the national parks are all open, even though the government's shut down, which is a bloody tragedy for the national parks.
Did you see the trash montage today?
Yeah, no, it's... Yeah. When we were in Joshua Tree on a few days ago, people were being incredibly respectful, and it was not out of hand at all. It was very, very... It was being very well taken care of, which it made me feel very good. But Thing 2 did some rock climbing up there, and I supported him and did a little bit myself. I didn't do any... I'm not actually contractually not allowed to do extreme sports.
Is rock climbing an extreme sport if you have ropes?
With belay?
It's listed on the form that I signed.
Oh, on the list of things you're not allowed to do. Okay.
Yeah, I can go to a climbing gym. Out in a while.
Can you go to a bouldering gym?
Yeah, that's even safer.
Is it?
Well, you're only ever a couple of feet above your crash pad.
And the one over here, you get like 15, 20 feet.
Oh, I haven't been to that one.
It's good. Dogpatch Boulders is real fun.
At any rate,
yeah,
we watched, at his insistence, Meru.
M-E-R-U. It's on Netflix.
It's a Netflix show, and it's about these three world-class climbers climbing a heretofore unclimbed peak in the Himalayas. 22,000 foot. The problem with this is it is like this 6,000 foot face where the last 2,500 feet is just this smooth granite shark fin.
Oh, God. in the snow.
What?
In the cold.
In the cold.
Yeah.
And so it's a documentary about two different attempts at this climb.
It can't be 22,000 feet, can it? Isn't Everest 18?
No, Everest is 29.
29, okay.
So there was one attempt in 2008, and then another attempt much more recently, which is what the film is about. But about half the film is the 2008 attempt, which is it's mind-blowing in and of itself.
To see the failure.
It's an incredible film.
Wow. Yeah, so okay. It's the filmmakers, this is like the rehearsal, because they made this, released in 2015, then also released the movie Free Solo.
Right,
this
so
year.
Free Solo is shot by Jimmy Chin and his wife, and Meru is Jimmy Chin not only filming this film, but also being one of the three climbers to summit Meru.
Well, because if you're going to film it, you got to climb it,
there's
right?
only three of them, right? Yeah. So they're handing the camera back and forth, they're living in this, you know, bivvy on the side of a mountain that collapses at one point, because part of it breaks when they're halfway up.
I can tell you right now, I don't think I can watch this because I'm already stressed out just hearing about it.
Dude, it is so, what these guys go through, they run out of, here's just one thing I'll tell you. They, on their first attempt, they run out of food on day 5 and they're up there for another 10 days.
Time to eat Jimmy.
So what is more intense? Because I haven't seen Free Solo yet, and Free Solo is about...
I haven't seen Free Solo yet either, but you and I both watched, we just checked before the podcast, we both watched that 10-minute doco from Jimmy Chin and his wife about filming it.
Yeah, so
about filming Free Solo.
Filming and the making of Free Solo, that one is just free on New York Times or YouTube. You can watch that. Highly recommended. There's also, the climber did a TED Talk, I believe, this year, and that's an 11-minute talk. About
Alex Honnold did?
Yes, he did.
Oh,
a TED Talk. I think it was from this year. That's on YouTube as well. But that's a 4-hour climb without rope.
Right.
What's more intense, that or the 2-week long
it's totally
journey with rope?
Totally different realities. The thing that I loved about that little doco about Free Solo was the filmmakers openly discussing their own complicity in their friend's demise because they're filming him doing the most dangerous thing they can imagine.
Yeah, the doco is called What If He Falls.
It's super intense, and I really appreciate that they made that part of the dialogue about the film. And apparently it's discussed within the film itself because as Alex Honnold spent 2 years prepping for the climb and repeatedly climbing El Cap and learning how he was going to do it, he came up with like, oh, here's a spot that's really, really tough. I don't want all the camera people are also top world-class climbers. They're all his friends.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't want my friends to watch me die. And I don't want to be thinking about my friends watching me dying. So in this particular difficult part of the climb, I needed to be remote cameras.
Is that the funny thing? Wow. Like he's less afraid of death, even though death is something to be afraid of. Less afraid of death than he is to die while his friends are watching.
Is he afraid
of death? I'm not sure that's an accurate boiling down. I think it's more that he wants to be concerned only with the climb. And on a difficult spot where he starts to realize my friends might watch me die, his mind is not on the climb. Mm. So it's not that one is more valuable to him than the other. It's about maintaining a perfect concentration. Mm. I haven't free soloed El Cap.
like thinking about the kind of focus and concentration and intensity you would have to do something like this. Like, I mean, I'm not a good climber, but I'm sure that if you spend 10,000 hours climbing, then you get to the point that climbing up the side of a normal mountain is like walking down the street for one of us, right?
Right.
You know, you just do it, and then you like you said, Norm, you know when you get to the hard part, and you know you need to focus. But I think that there's a level of complexity to this that doesn't account for in that, you know, most of what we do as, you know, semi-evolved primates doesn't involve putting your finger in the wrong place and then dying because of that, right?
Yes, it's true. The stakes are not 100%
all the time.
Of the things we do. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I feel like there's a special kind of person that has to be a top level climber, and then beyond that, there's a substrate of a substrate of a, you know, a skim off the top of a skim off the top of a skim off the top that is the kind of person who can free climb.
Well, so I do think there's a universality to unpack here to me, which is, and you know what, I've talked about having played pool really seriously back in the day. And I studied hustlers for a long time and read a lot of books about hustling. And one of the things I learned is that a pool hustler is not someone who's always going to be better at pool than you. They just know how to set the stakes to the point where you're thinking about the stakes and they're only thinking about the shot.
Yeah.
And I think of that as a very universal attribute of excellence, which is to say, when you find the thing that you're really good at, I think that you'll find specifically that the thing that stresses most people out about that thing is something that makes you calmer, right? Like,
that's really funny because the same applies to like painting something. We have a lot of friends who's like that. They don't want to paint their toys because they're afraid the end result will look bad. But when you're in the moment, you're just caring about that one spot. And you break it down, it's all discrete, you're quantifying it all in the tiny, tiny steps along the way and nothing about the end.
Well, and if you want to look at, I've seen film break a lot of excellent people because the stakes in film feel kind of crazy.
I mean, it's a huge machine with 10,000 people behind it.
Yeah, people staring at you while you're trying to get your gag done, and it's costing X number of dollars per minute. And I just remember finding when I was 24 that situation made me calmer rather than more stressed out.
We did some ad shoots a few years ago that, like, the tech that my company builds was the thing that everybody was relying on. And at first, in the time leading up to that, I was very worried about how our stuff was going to work.
Yeah.
And then once we got there, it just became about getting each shot and getting the work done and doing what we could do to make it easier for everyone, figuring out solutions on the fly. But I wasn't worried about the fact that it was costing $30,000 an hour or a minute or whatever our spend was.
Right. So, right. What you're bringing up that I realize is it's basically about where you can achieve total focus. So Honnold can achieve total focus in the most extreme circumstances that many people can picture.
And you called it excellence, and in his TED Talk, he talks about the exact same thing, but he calls it mastery.
Right.
And they're exactly the same thing, because he talks about how he climbed before he did El Cap years before he did Half Dome, mm-hmm. and he wasn't satisfied with that because he felt like he got lucky with one of the holds. It wasn't a mastering of it. And yeah. so he actually didn't do free soloing, he said, for over a year after that, because he didn't want to then fall into the trap of relying on getting lucky. And right. so the preparation right. for El right. Cap was 2 years, not because he didn't think he could do it, but he wanted to do it in a way where he felt like he had mastery over the accomplishment.
Not just the mountain, and it's not just his hands and his body, but it's also he's fighting his Dunning-Kruger and knows what he's not capable of, right?
Here's a tweet from a couple weeks ago. The first rule of Dunning-Kruger Club is that you don't know you're in Dunning-Kruger Club.
Hey everyone, Norm here. Before we continue on with the conversation, I want to let you know that this episode of Still Entitled is made possible by the podcast Hackable. Cybercrime has been all over the news and TV shows. Hackable, an original podcast from McAfee, answers the question, how worried should I really be about cybercrime? In each episode, host Jeff Siskin invites a hacker to try and hack a device he's using. Think Mr. Robot. In season 3, Jeff straps on a virtual reality headset, puts his laptop password on the line, investigates drones, and more. Listen to Hackable now on all major podcast platforms, and thank them for sponsoring this week's episode. Now back to the conversation.
Hey, Mythbusters, when is this going to go up?
This is going
to
go up today. And okay. Mythbusters Jr. aired.
Congratulations.
Thank
yesterday.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mythbusters Jr. premiered last night at 9 on Discovery. On Science Channel. Check your local listings. It will air again this weekend.
I don't get Science Channel as right. I discovered last night as a Hulu TV subscriber.
Yeah.
But when I added it to my DVR and went to look for it last night at 10 o'clock, I was like, I'm going to watch the show now. It's going to be on, I think, Discovery on the 5th.
Yes.
So it popped up for me even though it wasn't on last night.
If you go to Discovery.com and the Science Channel site, I believe you can actually download the episode and watch it online.
I watched it in an app on my phone called yeah. Science Go.
That's it, Science Go. I'm really proud of this show.
It's so good. It's so fun.
It's so delightful last night to live watch it with Twitter and hear the real-time responses. You know, a lot of what we were afraid is that people would be like, I used to like Mythbusters, but I don't want to watch a kid's show. Not a kid's show.
No.
And the press that I did, the LA Times and USA Today and a bunch of other outlets really covered that. Peter Hartlaub and Chronicle. It's been very gratifying that the responses are coming back and people are really seeing that we made something that is both deeply part of the culture of Mythbusters and also new.
I'd been on set a couple of times and I'd not seen a cut of the episode, but what surprised me is that it did two things with the idea of a kid, like a junior show. When I think about shows that feature kids, like, you know, Master Chef or American Ninja Warrior Kids, like, I feel like they can go in two directions. One, you can have kids that are really impressive that then do things as an adult I am impressed by.
Yep.
And then two, you can have kids really live out a fantasy so the other kids can, they are avatars for other kids for the aspirational wish fulfillment.
Yeah,
and I think
yeah.
this has both of that where they are clearly in fantasy camp,
yeah.
right? They're having a time of their lives.
Helicopter rides. And
and they show that enthusiasm, which is infectious, but at the same time, they're also doing the
yeah,
work
yeah.
and doing the driving and doing really impressive things. So that was really cool that it tapped into both those.
Just, you know, when you ask people if they've ever taken a helicopter ride before, even if they're not 15, most of them probably are going to say no, Adam.
Yeah, that's true.
It was fascinating watching the both you guys, you kind of guided the kids a little bit, it seemed like.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, they tackled the problems and knew what to do. And I love the division of labor. I love that you have somebody who's really good at engineering math and somebody who's good at electronic stuff to build sensor packages. And like, yeah. it was so cool watching them work together. And I would bet it was probably the first time they were presented with a group of people that are actually their peers in terms of what they're capable of across different fields for a lot of them. You know, if you're from South Dakota, there probably aren't a lot of kids that can operate at the same level as you
yeah.
that are your age.
And I agree. And it's just been so exciting to see also my new myth-busting colleagues getting to cut loose on Twitter and share photos and videos from behind the scenes that they've been holding on to for 6 months.
Oh, my God.
And yeah, I'm very excited. It's a really exciting year. I completed the very close to final draft of my book.
Awesome.
Wow. Over the holidays
You're on the road trip?
For Simon & Schuster, it's called Every Tool's a Hammer.
Okay.
Nice. I see what you did there.
This is coming out. It's half instructional, half autobiographical. The subtitle is Life is What You Make It. And it's about my history of making. The title Every Tool's a Hammer comes from one of my old ILM colleagues, the sadly late Mark Buck, was the best motorcyclist I ever knew. He got killed on his motorcycle a few years back, tragically, I believe at an intersection on 19th Avenue, side blindsided. Yeah. But Mark used to say, in every tool, there is a hammer. And it's, to me, one of the greatest maker axioms there is, that you can always use a tool for a purpose that was not intended in a pinch. And so that comes out on May 7th.
Oh, awesome.
I start production on the next show for Science Channel on Monday.
Wow.
In 4 days. So it's a very busy front half of 2019.
Too bad,
for me.
You have so much free time right now. I'm awfully sorry.
We may get a little light on the 1 day builds over the next couple of months.
We have a few pocketed.
Yeah. And we may have to do a couple of weekend day builds.
Hey, no problem.
You know, we have to shift our schedule just a little bit, because I got a couple things I got to do.
Yeah. Well, you got to get ready for con season this summer. You'll be clear by then, right?
I believe I'm not going to San Diego Comic Con. I think the next con I go to is New York. In October.
Yeah, wow. Because the 50th anniversary
of the NASA of Apollo 11. Yeah. I very well might be in D.C. Over the actual days of San Diego Comic-Con.
Wow.
Yeah.
So much influx.
There is so much influx. Holy hell, how exciting is it to see the most distant object NASA has ever...
Turns out it's BB-8.
I mean, but like they went within what 10,000 kilometers or something of a movie of an object that is 1,000 kilometers across, going 50,000 kilometers an hour, a minute, a second.
Right, it's
a
like
day.
Using a bullet with a GoPro on it to go film another bullet. Like about
and you don't know how it's going to go for 9 hours after the event.
Right. Yeah. Oh my god.
Or and we won't get all the data for what I think they said 2 years. Is what it's coming in at like 300 baud or whatever the speed of the deep space network is at that range.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
The patience of people who are in charge of the JPL folks who drive robotic explorers is astounding to me.
And the Chinese landed the first probe ever on the dark side of the moon, which isn't really dark.
Soft landing. First soft landing, yeah. And they drove out the little rover guy.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So...
I just gendered the rover. I apologize for that. That was bad.
Hilarious. What did you guys, aside from Spider-Verse, any other media that you took?
I saw Aquaman.
How is Aquaman?
It is worth seeing in the big screen.
Really?
It is a bombastic combination of every blockbuster that's come out in the past 10 years.
On a scale of Wonder Woman to Man of Steel, where does it fall?
I think it's more fun than Man of Steel, not as good as Wonder
Woman.
That's
a fairly low bar.
I mean, look, Wonder Woman was pretty good. Wonder Woman has a bad third act, but up to that, it's awesome.
I ignore the third act, just like I ignore all the other Raiders films.
Yeah. There's other Raiders films?
Exactly.
You know what I did watch? It was an interesting exercise. I watched both the original, I think 70s, Murder on the Orient Express.
Ooh.
And the Kenneth Branagh one, just as a point of comparison.
So the first one is Peter Ustinov. Jenny Ogeter's in that.
No. It's Lauren Bacall.
Oh, this is the black and white.
No. It's color. It's made in the 70s.
But isn't Peter Ustinov play Hercule Poirot?
No, Albert Finney.
Albert Finney! Oh my God!
Wow. Yeah, and Albert Agatha Christie said the only criticism she had of that adaptation was that his mustache was not as glorious as she has imagined being the best mustache in Europe. But Kenneth Branagh compensated for that with the most glorious mustache.
It's pretty
I've seen
amazing.
On screen.
It's an amazing mustache.
How did they compare?
It was fun to see the adaptation, the remake, tighten up things a lot. and reconfigure.
Just culturally, we like our films faster.
Yeah, and also the mystery and put things, and God, movies in the '70s were long.
Yeah, it took a lot of time.
Go watch The Sting, man.
Yeah.
It was a fast 70s movie, too.
Right.
But you have Ingrid Bergman, you had Sean Connery's in the 70s one, and it's really fun to see.
We've got to be coming up on the 40th anniversary of people bitching about the MTVization of film at this point, right?
Oh, I guess you might
What was the first...
Well, we tried to watch Rocky. I tried to show my kids Rocky, and Rocky, like, crawls along.
Well, a lot of the Scorsese movies, like Raging Bull, and a lot of that's like they're great, yeah. Fantastic films, but they're slow.
Oh, hey, we got to the end of The Americans.
Okay. Did the Americans win?
Does it stick the landing? All I want to know is, does it stick the landing?
It's an interesting thing. I can't say that it doesn't stick the landing, but I think they left money on the table. There's a specific showdown between. Two of the characters who have been secretly in opposition the whole time, and yet only one of them knew it. And that showdown feels exactly right. That denouement, that it feels terrific.
It's a very Breaking Bad situation in a lot of ways.
But there's so many ways in which the series tied itself up that I thought left way too much unsaid.
Wow, they probably left themselves an opening for just like Breaking Bad.
I would watch a sequel to this show. Yeah. I would watch. There's a lot about it that I would jump into. I've been obsessed with a YouTube channel that I'm a Patreon supporter of, Numberphile.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
I've been watching those guys go. And actually, Matt Parker is coming to San Francisco, and we're gonna figure out something to shoot.
That's cool.
He hadn't seen the Brachistochrome video that I shot with Mike Stevens from Vsauce. Yes. So I'm sitting there, like, my wife is watching me watch these videos. I've got headphones on. She's watching people do math diagrams. And every now and then she hears me go, oh. And she's like, are you, like, getting breathless about geometry? And I'm like, yes, baby, I am.
That's so good.
That's awesome. Netflix also has a new show about, it's like their version of Hoarders. It's called Tidying Up.
Oh, Marie Kondo.
Yeah,
I watched the trailer for that the other day.
And it's really interesting.
I feel like you should get her in here.
Marie Kondo?
Yeah.
I don't think you could do it.
I was thinking about this the whole time.
This
just might break her.
I want to see who wins. It's like a movable object. Like,
No.
The thing is, it is like that positive take, the Queer Eye meets Hoarders, where the people change their lives.
Right.
And I think it's less about... Like, if you're happy with the organization you have, clutter is not bad. It's about appreciating the things that you have.
She's very into, it seems like she's into venerating the objects that you love.
She is. And that's,
thing that I think you can,
She has ritualized the understanding that you get rid of things that you don't necessarily feel ready to get rid of.
And deeper behind
that's a difficult thing. Some people have the understanding of
your relationship with those things to a point. And it's okay if, like, you go through the things and you actually don't want to get rid of things because you have deep connections with everything. It's finding those connections again.
I watched the trailer for that, and I found it uplifting as it was intended. It's a well-cut trailer, and it looks like an enjoyable show. I found myself worried that the show would do this classic American television thing of, hey, you can fix your whole life by Thursday if you only have the right guidance and willpower.
Yeah.
Which is just one of the most...
Wait, what?
Screwed up.
I will say the first house they go to, it's not like 1 week. It's like a whole month.
Oh, really?
Of work.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So they stretch it out.
Oh, so you watched one of the episodes?
I watched two of the episodes.
Ah. Yeah. Did it make you want to tidy up your house?
It is so much triggering things. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, I can do this. No.
What's the? I just want her reaction when she gets to the front door.
You want? Okay.
I think we should bring her in for a podcast.
Marie Kondo,
you
are cordially invited to the cave.
We've got to film it though. The walk
by
in.
All means. Yeah.
We know the EP. Gail Berman produced it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Holy cow!
Small world.
We should reach out to Gail.
What's your media diet like when you're doing late night feedings and stuff, Norm? What are you watching with the kiddo?
Just music? I have noise canceling headphones and music now.
Okay.
I did a lot of This American Life.
Mm. Okay.
So one of the things that when the kids are infants, you can sometimes get them to sleep for long periods of time by putting them in the car seat and driving them around at night.
Yes.
And I used to do that for several months. I did that every night between like 11 and 2 a.m.
Oh, my God.
So that my wife could get some sleep.
Yeah.
And so I would just, I would call a buddy of mine in New York who like never slept, and we would just either chat for hours or I would listen to This American Life. Well, and I remember talking to a dad who in his neighborhood, he would pass other dads with newborns.
You would see there was one other dad that would, cause I'd load up in the stroller cause here it was cool enough. It wasn't a problem or warm enough. It wasn't a problem.
Right. Right.
And I would go on a late night walk like with the bear mace in case there were coyotes. And we'd just be bopping around the neighborhood with the stroller. And you'd see there was one other dad that was always out.
Yeah.
It's no longer the driveway moment for listening to NPR.
No.
It's the stroller and deep sleep moment.
I watched the entire run of Always Sunny, I think.
While I was
doing like late night feedings.
Yeah, yeah.
And Archer. So it was not appropriate viewing for children. But, no, you know.
You get away with
she that. Doesn't care.
Exactly.
She was fine.
Oh. Well, Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Yeah.
Glad to put an end to 2018. That was an intense year, and I hope that things are brighter this year. I hope they feel brighter. I hope they are brighter.
Things seem better. Fingers crossed.
Stay tuned for more awesome stuff. We got a lot of stuff.
Oh, hey, the just before we started the podcast, the Blade Runner blimp, now that we've revealed it.
Yes.
It just went home. It's now in my office at home, and I'm setting it up.
Oh, I finally watched Mute, the Duncan Jones, the third, I think, maybe, of the Moon trilogy.
Right. How is it?
It's neat. It's not what I was expecting at all. I loved the visual design of the film. I loved that it was ever so loosely connected to Moon.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked Paul Rudd in it. He's not what your typical Paul Rudd, which I can see would maybe turn people off.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, I think it is eminently worth watching. And of course it's on Netflix. So like, you know,
fabulous.
I still am thinking about it.
Nice.
It was very thought provoking.
Oh, very cool.
Well, send us suggestions. We'll probably do a Spider-Verse spoiler cast at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
Send us suggestions.
If you want to go see it again, I'm down to go again.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I will. Yes.
We'll talk about this offline.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay. All right. See you all later. Thanks for watching.
See you guys. Everybody.
Bye.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Thanks for listening this week. And once again, I want to let you know that this episode was made possible by the podcast Hackable from McAfee. Cybercrime has been all over the news and TV shows. Hackable, an original podcast from McAfee, answers the question, how worried should I really be about cybercrime? In each episode, host Jeff Siskin invites a hacker to try and hack a device he's using, kind of like in Mr. Robot. In season 3, Jeff straps on a virtual reality headset, puts his laptop password on the line, investigates drones, and more. Listen to Hackable now on all major podcast platforms and thank them for making this episode possible. We'll see you next week.